My name's Kenny. I'm an alcoholic. It's amazing to be up here at the Sierra Retreat Center and to be with some old friends and a lot of new friends and people I haven't met. So this is going to be, I just wanted to start off by, I want to thank especially Pacey and Rick that have got a hold of me, got me to do this retreat. I did this retreat maybe, we don't really know for sure, but we think it was about 18 years ago. It was Pacey's first retreat that he did here, and I think he's been at every one since. And so at least I had a good effect on one person. That's good. So I want to start off. I want to start off with a few statements of fact. And the statements of fact that I want to start off with is one, that I love you and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't believe that, I'm not asking you to take that. I just want you to know that you will know that to be true by the end of this retreat. I promise you that. If you'll stay through till Sunday, you'll know that that's something that's in my heart. The other thing that I know for sure is that God is present here with us this weekend. And God will be our one and only guide here in this process this weekend. The other thing that I would say is that this is a holy place. And it's a holy place for a lot of reasons. Father Charlie mentioned several of them. The way this property came about, the history that's here, the fact that they wanted to open it up for everybody. All of these things mean that we're on holy ground. But the real reason that I say that is because you're here. That's the thing that's the most important. That you are here, that's what makes this holy ground. That we have chosen this spot, this group, to come for this weekend to bring all of these things that you might have that are objectionable in your life, to set one weekend aside to just come and listen to what somebody else has and what other people's opinions are about the spiritual life and the life in Alcoholics Anonymous and in the 12 steps. So several people have asked me, come up and said, "Geez, have you done this before?" or some version of that question. And the answer is, not that wasn't always true. You know, that when I was 11 years sober, and I'll tell you, my sobriety date is June the 8th of 1989, so I'm 33 years sober. And when I was 11 years sober, a guy asked me to come down to Oregon and lead a 12-step retreat at Sky Camp in Eugene, Oregon, which is a retreat that's still going on, and I've been back now a couple of times to do that retreat. So the answer wasn't always yes, but now I've this is the second time I've done this retreat. It's overwhelming for me, honestly. It really is, to be sitting in this chair this weekend and be sitting here with you all for the second time in my sobriety is overwhelming. Because there's only two other people, I was told, that have been asked to come back and do the retreat. And I'm sure there's plenty that are qualified and will be asked back. But as we stand today, and two of those were great mentors of mine. One was the late, great Don Pritz, one of AA's great sponsors, a guy that carried the 12-step message all over the world and was able to change the lives of thousands of people. He was a guy that got to talk, he had talked to a lot of alcoholics and shared his story. The other was Tom Ivester, and Tom Ivester, I think, was here twice as well, is my understanding. And he also was a mentor of mine and a good friend and somebody that became, and the reason that I know these things work, these retreats and going and doing AA talks and that kind of thing, the reason that I know that works is when I was young in sobriety, early in sobriety, once in a while I would get a cassette tape, which is the way that they would record these back in those days. And I would have a cassette tape on an AA speaker, and I would listen to it, and I would just think, if I could get a hold of this guy, if I could just talk to this person, if I could find, I was thinking I'll go to Vancouver, BC, where this great speaker was that I'd heard in early sobriety, or I could go to Denver, Colorado and find this Don Pritz, or go to North Carolina and find this Tom Ivester. And I got to know them and got to know them actually pretty well and got to use them as mentors. And these were the kinds of things that lifted me up and set me on my feet in Alcoholics Anonymous was that. So I know that doing what I'm doing helps to change people's lives, and it changes. And I also want to say, when I come and do these retreats, I've done retreats in Akron and New Mexico and in Louisiana several times. Been down to Louisiana and all over. I mean, I could keep going, but the point is, every time I've had the same experience, and that was that I walk away thinking, I think that retreat changed me as much as it changed anybody in the room. You know, I have to get calm and peaceful and think about what it is that we're going to be doing this weekend, and I try not to repeat too many things, but I try to share what's kind of my more recent experience, which I want to get to. So one of the things that I have done that I do at a lot of these retreats, and I wrote it on this piece of paper up there, and somehow I'm looking at it now, and I can't barely see it from here, and I know you can't see it from the back. And the ink kind of somehow was much brighter when I wrote it, actually, but it's faded quite a bit already for some reason. But I'm going to read it to you. And it's not so important that you did at the break, if you want to get a picture of this, get a picture of it. This is a prayer that I wrote for these retreats. And it states a little bit about why we're here for this retreat. So I'm going to read this through once. And you can follow along. And then I'm going to read it again and talk a little bit about why I wrote this and what the words in this thing mean. It says, God, as we retreat, as we withdraw from, all we see is hazardous, unpleasant, and difficult. As we retreat from positions in our thinking, attitudes, and knowledge, let us rest this weekend in this place of privacy and safety. In prayer, meditation, and study, allow this retreat to deepen our awareness of life, our sense of humor, our love for everything and for all, and our desire to live the spiritual life. So when you think about retreat, you know, you think about that we're retreating from a place of discomfort. People in battle will go as long as they can, and then the command will come in to retreat, and they're backing up from a position that they'd taken previously, and they realize that this position is not a position we can hold, and so they retreat. The other thing that comes to me when I think about retreat is that in a retreat, and I'd ask for everybody, you know, to kind of consider this, especially people that have been sober a while, is that in AA, we have a specific treatment for alcoholism. And the specific treatment is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're outlined in our basic text, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the treatment we have for alcoholism. When somebody comes in suffering from untreated alcoholism, that's the treatment that we offer through sponsorship, through sitting down and reading the book to somebody. And it's one of those terms I wish someday I will coin some kind of a phrase, or I'll ask somebody else, will give it to me, of that my sponsor's reading the book to me, or I'm reading the book. It just doesn't really do justice of what it really is, because what it really is, when we take somebody through the steps in that manner, which we'll talk about this weekend a bit, it's really like, I'm going to read and I'm going to share about that paragraph in the book and what it was like for me and my experience, and I'm going to offer that to you. And it's a place where we are, that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of these traditions that we do. And in that place, it's God working through me, delivering a message to another person. It's not just this reading the book that you hear. I mean, there's so much more to that. And the thing that I think about when I'm in that place is that in that process, I am anonymous. And I hope that will happen this weekend, that I can realize that in this process, I'm just another anonymous member of AA coming here because I've been asked to come here and I'm grateful to come here. But I am no more spiritual than anyone in this room. And the thing that I think about is that one of the great facts for me that's come about is I have realized that I am no less spiritual than anybody in this room either. That's even more important. That in this process, you know, we're all equal. So this prayer that I read, you know, when we think about retreat, you know, it's not just to retreat from these things that we admit are objectionable and come up here once every year and come up to the Sierra Retreat Center and set everything aside. And I hope that people will have the ability here. You'll see my cell phone here, but it's on airplane mode, and it's going to remain on airplane mode probably most, if not all, the weekend. And I would ask everybody to consider just being present here and just concentrate on the spiritual life for one weekend. And it doesn't matter who you are. This idea of retreating is in as near as I can tell, it's in every spiritual culture on earth. I know for sure that if we were to have asked our friar, Father Charlie, he would tell you that they regularly, the friars, they go on retreat for the same reason. And also to allow yourself to, we have this piece that many of us, I think, use, and I think it's quite in use down here in California, called the set-aside prayer, and there's various versions of it, and I'm not going to get into it. But really, really says is that, you know, God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience. And when we, with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. And it doesn't matter how long you've been sober, if you'll do that. You know, the question is, for me, at 33 years sober, can I have another one of these spiritual awakenings that's going to change my life to the degree that it did from the time I was 0 minutes sober when I came to AA, and I was literally 0 minutes sober when I came into AA, and what my life was like a year sober or 2 years sober, the change was so dramatic that other people that even knew me didn't believe what they were seeing happen. And so can I have that same degree of change happen sober many years that happened then? And for me, the answer is yes, because I've had that experience several times with finding a new mentor or a new person to that I've asked, and I've placed myself in the hands of somebody new and asked for and went and had a whole brand new experience that's completely revolutionized my way of thinking. So we're withdrawing from these things we see as hazardous, unpleasant, and difficult in our lives. So you think about what is that? We were retreating from these positions that we've taken in our thinking, in our attitudes, and in our knowledge. So it says, let us rest this weekend in this place of privacy and safety. We're safe and protected here. In prayer, meditation, and study, that's what we're going to be doing this weekend. Allow this retreat to deepen our awareness of life, our sense of humor, which is important. I'm going to try to use that as much as I can this weekend. But I think there's two things that really awaken the spirit in a suffering alcoholic. And those two things are hopelessness, when we talk about the hopelessness of our condition, when we talk about our stories from that perspective, it hits people in the heart and they wake up a little bit. And also, if you can get a hopeless alcoholic laughing, and especially if you can get them laughing a little bit at themselves and tell some things, and it's right there in our book, you know, that if the mood is light, try this approach. Our love for everything and for all, and our desire to live the spiritual life. So, what we're going to do this weekend, there's an idea that we're spiritually asleep, and that through these 12 steps, we will awaken spiritually. That spiritually, when I came to AA, I'm asleep. And I can, not only can you have a spiritual awakening, but you can go back to sleep spiritually. And it's one of the saddest things is that I think there's different terms for different people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's, to put that in perspective, the difference is that there's somebody that, there's certain people that come to AA, and they are, and I'm just being really careful with my words here because I don't want to sound judgmental when actually I am, but I have been, or I will fall into that. So I'm trying to choose words that don't reveal that part of my personality. But the situation is that there are people that I think that I feel in AA that come and they stay sober. And they go to a lot of potlucks and picnics and events and meetings, and they've got a great fellowship around them. And you never hear them talking about making amends or paying the money back they're not sponsoring anybody. They're not being a service in the meeting. And the frustrating part of that whole thing is that they're relatively happy. That's the toughest part of the whole thing, because you'd expect if somebody's like that and they're an alcoholic and they're untreated alcoholism, they'd be miserable, but they're relatively happy people. And on the other end of the spectrum is a fellow who comes to AA, and these are the guys that break our hearts. They come to AA, and they completely are, every sentence, everything that we're doing, they're highlighting in the book, they're writing in the margins, they're like, this is amazing when they're reading Bill's story, like this is like somebody's reading my mail, how did they know these things? They're just having this huge first step experience, and they come to believe, and they hit their knees in the third step, they make the decision. They write their inventory, they come and do their fifth step, and they don't withhold anything. They let it all go. The deepest, darkest secrets, the take it to the grave stuff, they bring all of that and they let it all go. And they humbly approach all this in steps 6 and 7. They're humbled, they ask God to remove these things, and they're sincere in their prayers. And they make their 8-step list, and the 8-step list is complete, and they start making their amends, and they stop making amends for a week, and they get drunk. And that's the other end. And, you know, so I would invite everybody to really think about, like, where are you in that? And it was one of the greatest gifts that was ever given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I realized that in that piece of how it works, and it says that you know, there are those that are constitutionally incapable of being entirely honest with themselves, and it doesn't say that. And that was me for sure. You know, I mean, I just, in the book tells us, can't tell the difference between the truth and a lie. You know, that we are unable to decipher that, and so it doesn't say that person can't stay sober. It says our chances are less than average. And so for me to find out that I didn't have to worry about what anybody else was doing to stay sober, that I was a guy whose chances were less than average, that was, I got to a place where for whatever reason, like this huge gift, I believed what these guys were telling me when they were telling me that, you know, that when I got to my amends, the question was, does this have anything to do with whether you're going to be able to stay sober or not? And I knew that if I didn't go pay that money back, if I didn't go back and make amends for the shoplifting that I did, if I didn't go back and set these burglaries straight, if I didn't go back and go to my mother and my brother and my sister and my, if I didn't go back to the judge and go back and go to the fire department that had to come to my house continuously to revive somebody that had overdosed and, you know, all of those things, that I was going to drink again. And I knew that if I withheld anything in that fifth step, that the time and day would come when I would drink again. I knew that to be true. And so that was like a blessing, because I still look back on it and I just think, how in the world did that happen? So I want to take a few minutes here. I've got a schedule here, actually, and we're not going to abide by this schedule exactly, but it'll give you a rough idea of what time we're meeting and when we're going to have breaks and how long the breaks will be. And we're going to try to stay as close to this as we can on the time. The stuff in this other column of what it is that we're going to be doing and talking about, these are just reminders a little bit. But this group is going to go where it's going to go. In the back, I think, there's earplugs in the back on the table back there somewhere. And there's an Ask-It basket. Is that also somewhere? Is that on the... Oh, behind me? Is this it? Where's the pens in? I think what's on the chair back there is the Ask-It basket. The earplugs are somewhere close by. The earplugs are over there. Thank you. So the earplugs are over there to my left. And in the back, standing where Glenn is pens and some 3x5 cards. And we'll get more 3x5 cards in there. So at each session or so, we will get the Ask-It basket. And we're going to try to get some interaction going so that people have a chance to ask questions, get questions answered. And other people besides myself can feel free to, during that time, to step in as well and offer some of their experience. So we're going to try to have this be as interactive as we can, being that we're here at this retreat, and I don't want this to just, you know, there's no lectures to be endured, and so I want to make sure that no one's enduring a lecture here, that we're here together as a group, and this is your retreat, and we're gonna I can promise you, we're gonna have a great time this weekend. You're in good hands. We're gonna have, if you'll stick through this and stay, and I mean stay till the end on Sunday, I would recommend it. And it doesn't bother me. If someone goes and they've got to go, then go. If you need to get up and go use the bathroom or get a drink of water or something, please feel free to come and go. I don't notice. It doesn't bother me. It's not going to it's not going to have a big effect on this retreat. So please just be comfortable. I want you to do that. But I want you also to remember that we're taping this retreat. And so there's retreats where they're taped, and there's ones that we don't. And when we tape, we're going to do our best job to get a good recording for Rick so that he can get that all to you. Because wouldn't it be a shame if we spent the whole weekend here and only the people in this room were the ones that got touched by this retreat? You know, we want this to change everybody and people to be able to go out from here and share this experience with other people and you know, have this, bring it back and have better 12-step work in your area, have better sponsorship in your area, have this. So thank you, Rick, for doing the taping and the recording. I think is probably a better word nowadays. I don't think we're using tapes, but we're gonna. So when we do the Ask-It basket, we're gonna have the microphone So as soon as we get some questions back there, anytime you just feel like grabbing that, or we can, you can pass it around if people want to pass it around, and you can, if we don't have more of those cards, we can tear those in half maybe and write a question on a half one so that we can go a little further, and we'll get some more paper and stuff in there at one of the breaks. So that's going to be a little bit about what we do. I've got a lot of stuff planned here this week, you know, in my mind, but I don't really know what we're going to be doing. I mean, I know we're going to start here, and I know when we're going to end on Sunday, and everything in between is going to be, we're going to pray, we're going to meditate together, and I'll introduce this singing bowl. Who's doing the meditation? Somebody, Ray, who's doing the meditation in the morning? Thank you so much. That's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to that. So I brought this singing bowl. I didn't know, have any idea that we were doing the singing bowl meditation in the morning. I brought this singing bowl from my home for this retreat. And I usually, because it, you know, it's a little bit much to pack in a suitcase, I usually have a little chime that I bring for these retreats. And I couldn't find it anywhere. And when I can't find something, it's always my wife's fault. So that she has taken my chime somewhere and hidden it from me. I'm quite certain that that's where my chime is. So I brought the bowl, which I'm glad I brought. And the history of this bowl is this was given to me after a retreat that I did, a workshop that I did in Seattle. I do these workshops, and I haven't done one in many years because I just got to a place where I felt like somebody else needs to pick that up and start doing these workshops. You know, I was doing one every year, and I did that for a long time. And in those workshops, it was an AA meeting. We would get together, and we would have a group of people get together that were committed to work in the 12 steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end, and we would go through as a group all 12 steps together. And that was the experience that I had in early sobriety, was somebody was in Seattle and did a big book workshop. And that's how I first got introduced to the big book workshops and big book work. And back in 1989, a few months sober, I was in the book. And I'm so grateful that not only did I get sober when I got sober, but I got sober with the guys that I got sober with, because, you know, they were experts at giving in AA. And I got in with a group of guys that were experts in taking people through the 12 steps. So we've got a lot of people here. I think there's, I don't know if there's 60 or 65, something like that here this weekend. And I think we're still expecting some more will show up. And I'm going to tell you a little bit. We're going to go with this session. We're going to go till 8:30. Then we'll take a break for about 15 minutes. And then we'll come back at 8:45 and we'll meet till 9:15 or so. We'll do a short final session tonight. And like I said, I got a little bit of people come up, take a picture of this if they want. I'll leave that up there. I was just trying to think, like, the last time I was here, Clint Hodges was here. And you know, I just love that guy. He was another one of those mentors, and I got a chance to bring him up to Seattle and have him come up and do a couple retreats for us up there so people could get to know him. And my wife and I came down and saw Linda and Clint a few times and spent time with them down here. They became quite close friends, and I was down here for his service when he passed away. I don't know if he founded this retreat or if he's the founder of this retreat. Pacey's indicating, and Jeff in the back there's indicating yes, but you know, to be here again is just so humbling. And it's easy, I think, for people to think, well, geez, I didn't really know him, you know. I didn't, I never had any experience. And so they feel a little like out of place a little bit when people talk so much about Clint or Tom or Don Pritz. And what I can say is the good thing is about those guys is there's a lot of recordings out there of Clint H. from Los Angeles, California. And if you don't, haven't got to know him, get to know him that way. And I can tell you, like, one of my great mentors is Chuck Chamberlain. And, you know, I never got to meet Chuck Chamberlain because I got sober in 1989. He died before I ever got sober. So I never got a chance to meet him. But he's one of my great mentors, and I don't really think, I mean, I don't feel any longer like I missed out. Like, gosh, I wish I'd have been. And I hope when I tell these kinds of stories about Clint or other people, that people understand that there's no difference between people that knew Clint and didn't know Clint, or that had, you know, it just is what it is, and people can get to know him, and he can continue to mentor people through his tapes and things. But when you know, he had this story when he was a dental assistant. People remember this. You know, when Clint was a dental assistant, he actually went to dental school and tried to become a dentist. He ended up becoming an attorney instead. After he got sober, he became an attorney, but he flunked out of dental school. And when he was in dental school, they would practice on people that couldn't afford a real dentist. So the students would practice on these poor people, and Clint would be drinking away and taking pills and stuff, and then he'd be numbing this guy up with the Novocaine and drunk out of his mind, numbing this guy up with Novocaine, holding him in there, getting him, okay, we got you all ready here. And then he said he walked out of the room and his left hand started going numb, you know, because he shot himself up with that Novocaine. And the best thing about that story is, later on in his life, and people will maybe remember this, much later on in his life, he came clean that story wasn't entirely true. And he'd been telling it all over the states. But he said, you know, he didn't want to let things get in the way of such a good story, and he just couldn't let it go because it was just so good. But he did operate on people when he was drunk, when he was doing that, and he had put Novocaine in his hand a few times by mistake. But he just kind of put all those pieces together. And it was one of the things that made Clint, I think, really so lovable and so enjoyable to be around. Was he was just a real guy. He wasn't trying to pretend to be anything that he wasn't. So I feel his presence here at this retreat. I just wanted to say that when we were going around the room and introducing ourselves and everything, you know, I just felt his presence here. And when I was here the last time, and I remember this for a good reason, but there was a show on television at that time, and it was a sitcom, and in this sitcom, the boss in the sitcom had gone to treatment, and he'd been doing a lot of drugs and doing a lot of coke. And he was acting goofy as hell, and they ended up, okay, the boss has to go to treatment. So now the boss is getting out of treatment. The boss is back at home. And the boss says, you know, everybody's talking, and, you know, this show was, the setting was in the office, and they're talking about, God, what are we going to do here when he comes back? How should we act and all these things? But it was real obvious that the writers of the show were, somebody in there had some experience with AA. That part was obvious. So at this retreat, somebody came and whispered in my ear that they had some information about that. And yeah, that was true, that they knew some of the people that were the comedy writers on the show, and that their sobriety had get. But the thing that was the funniest thing about that was that and I told that story the last time I was here, and I don't tell it that often, but the punchline of the whole thing is, these guys in the office are really nervous that the boss is coming back, and how should they treat him? Should they, when they go out to drink, should they ask him to come or should they not? All that stuff, you know, nervousness, and what should they say, and God, if we say this, or what if he comes back and he finds all this work on his desk, is he going to be overwhelmed and stuff? And so they come into his office, they say, well, how was it in treatment? He said, oh, it was great, you know, it was great, and I'm sober, and I feel so much better. And they said, well, what did you do in treatment? And he says, well, we did all kinds of stuff, but I really learned how to meditate and calm down. I learned how to do needlepoint. And they were like, needlepoint, really? And he was like, yeah, I learned how to do the needlepoint, where you'd kind of, you know, do the little stitching and do a little needlepoint and frame it out. And then he pulled out this little piece that he'd done the needlepoint on, and he shows it to him. And on this piece it says, God, I want some Coke, is what it said on this piece. And that's a little bit of my story, you know. That's just a little bit of the this merciless obsession, the kind of hold that had on me. I was a guy that would have sat in treatment, wishing that this sobriety was going to wash over me somehow. And the only thing I could think about the whole time I was there was more. And when I got out, it was curtains. I'll tell you a little bit about my story. And and June 8th, right? Who had the June 8th birthday? I had June 8th, 1989 for me. And I should say my home group is Magnolia Speaker Meeting in Seattle, Washington. And I hope you can, when you come to Seattle, you'll feel free to get a hold of me and come up and visit us. It's a Friday night, 8 o'clock meeting, and we have a really big crowd and a really great energetic bunch. And this is my second time at the retreat, as I said. So the on June 8th of 1989, I was behind a McDonald's restaurant. And I'd had some success in my life. I was 28 years old. I'd had some success in my life. I'd fished up in Alaska and worked on fishing boats and made some money. And when I was 23 years old, I was the chief engineer on a fishing boat where there was 8 crew members, and it was a big deal. I was in charge of taking care of all the engines and the auxiliary engines and the plant and the hotel and the cranes and everything on the boat, on repair and all that stuff. I was 23 years old. I never went to a day of high school. I was incarcerated as a juvenile. And all of my high school years were locked up, and then because I started doing crimes to try to get alcohol and drugs, so I'd come out of that experience, and my grandfather, who was in that business, thought, well, maybe we should send Kenny up to Alaska on a fishing boat. Maybe that'll straighten him out. And which is you might think that's a really insane idea, because it was the wild, wild west back in Alaska in those days. It really was. I mean, and I'm still involved in that business now, barely, but I still am in that business. I consult, and I have some clients that are in that business, and I work with a lot of the fishing boats up in Alaska. And back then, it was the Wild Wild West. Now, it's like way, way, way tamer, because a lot of people got hurt and killed, and boats sank, and the Coast Guard came in, and they cleaned things up considerably. But it was the Wild Wild West. I mean, there was nobody, and we were drinking around the clock on the boats. There was the people that we didn't just work hard and play hard. You know, we played hard while we were working. While we were out there working on the boat, you know, it was just customary that there was some drugs being passed around, and everybody was passing bottles around, and it was just completely off the hook. And these guys that I was drinking and doing drugs with, 2 times they passed the basket and put me through treatment. Told me, Kenny, you know, we can't have you on the boat. You've got to go to treatment. And many of those guys I'm still in contact with, back in contact with, through sobriety and having made my amends. And some of them are even among my good, close friends today, the same people. But, there's a part in Bill's story, and in this last session for tonight, we're going to open the book up a little bit, and I'm going to share some of my experience. But the One of the things that Bill talks about is how he barely drew a sober breath for this long period of time. And that was the last 3 years of my drinking. These guys had put me through treatment twice and then fired me when I didn't stay clean and sober. And I went from a guy that had a place to live and a house and some decent stuff to a guy that had absolutely nothing. And I was living on the streets, and I couldn't even come up with a game to get me into a cheap motel room. And I had a lot of cheap motel rooms at the time, you know, that there was, my friend Glenn, who came up with me from Seattle, and and we've had a great time down here. I came up here on Wednesday and talked at a meeting, shared at a meeting here on Wednesday night, and then we've had a couple days and been having a great time. The point is that when I was in that, you know, like those last 3 years of my drinking, it was that merciless obsession that the book talks about. You know, gone were the things they talk about in A Vision for You. And it's so amazing, our book, how it starts out with the doctor's opinion, and it really describes alcoholism, just this really eloquent way that it describes alcoholism in the doctor's opinion. And then they kind of depart from the alcohol for a long period of time, and you're going through the steps. And in A Vision for You, he comes back and talks about alcoholism at that hopeless depth and says that, you know, that the camaraderie of the past and this enjoyment, this camaraderie with friends, all this stuff, the stuff that we used to, you know, be around our drunken buddies and put our hands around them and say, God, I love you, you know, and all that stuff. And just knowing that the guys that we were drinking and they had our backs and all that stuff. They said, not so with us in those final days of heavy drinking. You know, those were in the past. They were memories. Never could we recapture those great moments of the past. And the only thing that I was left with in the end was this obsession for more. That was it. That was the only thing that was left in the end, that there was this insane obsession for more, that if I could get enough in, and it was the right kind, and it was the right mixture of all of the, and I could just get the right combination of everything, and I could get that in, then I would be able to, whew, oh, I'd be able to relax for a second. And I thought, from that place, then I'm going to stop. I'm going to be able to quit, and I'm going to go to treatment. I had all kinds of plans. And as many of us here know, that in when you're drinking and drugging like that, that one day turns into a week, and a week turned into a month, and a month turned into 3 years. And 3 years into that, the motels were gone, the girlfriends were gone, the friends' couches were gone, my family wouldn't answer the phone. I tried to call my brother at one point and get my brother told me that I can't have you over because you scare my children. My mom, the last time that I had seen my mom, I drove down to Vancouver, Washington from Seattle, where she was, and tried to get sober. And my mom said that she couldn't recognize me when I was at the door of her house. So that's where I was at on June 8th, 19. I was behind this McDonald's restaurant. And with alcoholism, our book says, goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And that was the way it was. All of those things that I just mentioned were gone. Everything. Friendships, the love, the camaraderie with friends, the feeling that life was good, the relationship with my family, all of it was gone. And the only thing left was this, what the book calls our merciless obsession. And somehow I got out from behind that McDonald's restaurant, and I got to an AA meeting. There was an AA fellowship hall. This was in a little strip mall, and I was in an AA fellowship hall. And in that fellowship, or in that, there was an AA fellowship hall. In that strip mall was the hall and this McDonald's. And this McDonald's, along the front was a facade in this McDonald's. So it looked like one building. But if you went around in behind, there were, you could crawl up, go through some bushes and crawl up a little rockery, and you could get in between these two buildings. And I joke about it sometimes now, but I don't like to think about it like I'm trying to say, like, being homeless is so easy nowadays, and back in the day, you know, being homeless was way harder, and because I don't believe that, but the and I don't want to make light of that, but it just was the way it was. In these days, you had to hide your homelessness. You know, you couldn't. If I had tried to have pitched a tent out on the street, these cops would have beat me within an inch of my life, you know. It just wasn't going to happen. But I'd found one of these really killer spots, you know. I was behind this building in bushes. Nobody could see me back in there. And I was laying in the dirt. I'd drug a huge piece of cardboard, like a refrigerator-sized box, back there. And I'd made a little lean-to out of it. And that's where I would come and go. And I would hear people drive through the drive-through of that McDonald's restaurant, and it, one after the other, I'd hear them, and just, you know, late into the night, and one after the other every 30 seconds or so, and they would say, yeah, I'll have a number 3 supersize with a Diet Coke, and I would hear them, I would hear, hey, somebody call the FBI, there's a freak back there shooting Coke, you know, and I'd be like, oh, man. And it was just this intensely nervous way to live, you know, just kind of this nervousness every day. Oh, my God. And I swear I was months sober before it really came to me that I was sitting in a meeting and I was thinking, you know what? I think that they delegate this responsibility of flushing drug addicts out from behind McDonald's. I think they delegate that to a little bit lower authority than the FBI. You know, I don't think that FBI is really dealing with that kind of stuff. And they delegate it to, like, way down, like the assistant general manager of the McDonald's. He's the guy that gets that job. You know, like, it's like way down there. And I walked into an AA meeting. I still to this day, I don't know where that strength came from or what. There was a guy that I knew that was going to that hall, and I knew he was staying sober. And I think I thought if I went there and he was there, that he and his girlfriend would take me in and nurse me back to health. That's what I thought. But I went, and he wasn't there. I don't know if I just assumed that he lived there at the, or whatever, but he wasn't there. It was a Thursday night. It was 8:00, and I walked in the door. There was a bunch of big crowd on the back porch of this place, and I just couldn't get the nerves up to walk up and through all of those people, and that's how everybody came and went out of the hall, was out of the back door, because that's where the parking lot and everything was. I got up, and I walked all the way around the block to go in the front street, to go in the front door, which nobody ever used in this hall. I came in, when I didn't know that, but I came in the front door and I took the seat closest to the door and I sat there, and a couple minutes later the 8:00 meeting started, and I don't have a clue what happened in the meeting. I do think that I disrupted the meeting a little bit, you know, by moaning or, you know, under my breath, kind of acting a little crazy, and they came and told me to, hey, you know, you can stay here, but you got to calm down, and the meeting, and the end of the meeting, and something happened to me that I didn't expect, and I was sitting there, and I just started crying in this AA meeting, like big time crying, and I think about that today, and it's like this hollow, like I just, and I remember that feeling even when I was behind, like there was nobody home, like this internal light was completely extinguished, just completely gone. I just felt hollow. So I didn't feel any emotions with the tears. I only felt the, I mean, I knew I was crying, but I could have been laughing, and it would have, I think, felt about the same way. I just, that was the way it was. Don P. says, used to say about he would cry at hockey games and laugh at funerals. That's what that was. You know, I just no control over our emotional nature, as it says on page 52. And a guy came up to me, and that's why I like to say that I like that to say that I was blessed to have been approached by experts in Alcoholics Anonymous in giving. And a guy came up, and I just talked to him today. He was just my sponsor. I still write him down. I still call him my sponsor, even though I've had many spiritual mentors along the way. Al is my sponsor. He's the guy that brought me into AA and helped me through. But he came up to me, a total stranger. There wasn't a person on this planet that would have given me $2. And a total stranger came up and said, "Listen, our guy's been talking a little bit. And if you would be willing to go to detox, we'll give you a ride right now. And matter of fact, we've already made some calls and they got a bed waiting for you." And, you know, my first thought was, how in the hell does this guy know I need to go to detox? That, and to give you a picture, I had everything that I owned was in a little plastic garbage bag. And that was that. There was stuff out behind the McDonald's that I'd collected, but the things that were too valuable in life to leave behind the McDonald's were in my bag. And in that bag was a pair of shoes. And I was in that meeting, sitting there barefoot in this meeting, filthy, dirty, hadn't showered in at least a few weeks since the last time I'd been able to get into a hotel room and get cleaned up. I was skinny, emaciated. And the reason that my shoes were in the bag and not on my feet is because my feet had abscessed and my feet were hurt and I couldn't get my shoes on. And so that's how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I told the guy, "Well, I need to get my affairs in order, you know." He said, "Well, how long is that going to take?" And I told him, "Oh, about maybe 10 minutes or so." I needed to go back behind the McDonald's, just make sure that there wasn't anything back there that I could ingest before I went to the detox. And I didn't have any. So I got in the car, and they drove me to detox, and Al picked me up after 5 days in detox. He picked me up. I was still sick as a dog when he picked me up, like really sick still, but they were done with me at detox. And so, and Al took me to a car lot that he owned on Highway 99 in Seattle, which is it, that, and it's on 82nd and Highway 99. The car lot's still there. He doesn't own it anymore, but it's a little, it was a little dirt lot. For people that know this, I mean, it was literally just a piece of dirt and a little building with about 10 or 12 cars on it. And these cars were, the most expensive car I think on the lot was maybe $1,000 back then. You know, these were cars that he would buy at auction that had a blown head gasket or something, and then he would fix them and get them running, and then and he would buy them for almost nothing, and then put them out on his car lot. But in the back of that car lot, there was a bed and a bathroom and a door that closed and a little place to heat some food up and a little refrigerator. And Al took me to that place from detox and brought me into the car lot and let me stay at the car lot. And every day for 6 months, he would come and he would knock on the window and he would wake me up. And I don't remember him, he did it for longer than that, but I don't remember him ever missing a day when he didn't, when, and till I was 6 months sober before I ever remember him missing a day where he took a day off, because he was working 7 days a week trying to get this business going on the car lot. And he would knock on the window. He would wake me up. He would take me up to Jack in the Box restaurant, and he would buy me a breakfast Jack and a cup of coffee, and he would talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I think about that, like, one of the biggest miracles of that whole thing is, and I'll say this, I was still living at that car lot when I turned 1 year sober. And shortly after that, through making amends and stuff, I got back into the business, which I was completely blackballed from. I got back into the business, and I was able to start working. I went and made my, because I went and made some amends. And one of the owners of the company said, you know, I can't put you back with the kind of responsibility you had before, but if you want to come down and just kind of help get the boats ready and chip paint and do a few things, you can do that. And so that I got my first job and was able to get off the car lot after. But I was at 1 year sober. I got to go up, and Al came to the car lot. I couldn't wait, and I was like, 1 year sober, baby. And he was like, no. That was 8 o'clock at night when you came in, dude. You're not sober 1 year till 8 o'clock tonight. So you got to wait to go up to the 8 o'clock meeting, and then you can celebrate. And I was a little pissed, you know. I was like, all this, I got a year sober, and this is what I get. And I left, and I walked, and he would have me walk up to this hall. And this hall that I was going to every day was a stone's throw from, literally a stone's throw. I would go right by that McDonald's every day. I got there, and I got the, went to the meeting. I got one year. And happy 1 year, by the way. We're not going to do this to you. We're going to make a big deal out of you. But this is good, and it's so fantastic that you're here and have 1 year of sobriety today. And I really mean that. That is really special. And I got to sit with you at dinner tonight and find that out, and that was really amazing. But I went up, and we went to the meeting, and they didn't make that big of a deal out of it. You know, there was a couple other people there that were having birthdays that night too, and it wasn't, you know, all the attention wasn't on me. And I was quite disappointed, and I left, and it was dark. You know, we'd have the meetings for an hour and a half. It was 9:30, and I walked back to the car lot. Lights are all off. Al's was always after, you know, he would leave, and I would be alone at the car lot. And I walked in to the car lot, and I went back into my little room where I had the bed, and I turned on the light, and there was a little tiny cake with one candle in it sitting there. And it was just the sweetest deal that I just got to celebrate, just sitting there with that deal and just thinking about what had happened to me. And the miracle of the whole thing is, and I think there's miracles like this in AA all the time, is 82nd and Highway 99, 82nd and Aurora, was a really bad neighborhood where this car lot was. And it's still a very bad neighborhood today. And it hasn't gotten any better. And I don't know that it's got any worse, but it hasn't gotten any better, that's for sure. And up and down that whole thing are these hotels and stuff. And in those hotels, one of them was a place where you could, one of the places that I would go often. And the rooms were less than $20, I remember that. And when you got a room, you had to put a deposit down of $1.50 to get a towel and a bar of soap. They give you a towel, a bar of soap, and a little wash rag. Just like when they walked in here, you know, a little stack. They'd give that to you. Because they'd be the kind of people they were renting rooms to were the kind of people that were going to boogie with the towel, you know. They weren't, and so they charged for the towel. And I knew all the people that were, I knew people in all those hotels, the prostitutes and the drug addicts and the men and women that were in the rooms and that were working the streets there. I knew them all. And And I look back on it today and I just think, man, like how in the world did I ever stay sober in the middle of all of that, in the thick of all that stuff going on? And you know, it was, there was part of me, I think I didn't want to disappoint Al. There was part of me that, you know, I'd wanted to stay sober worse than anything ever. You know, I went to treatment, to probably 6 different treatment centers before that. And I'd been in jail a lot of times too. And I didn't, every time there was just this, but I just couldn't, you know, it was just that, you know, we're not ready until we're ready part. And so when you're here today and you're sober, man, what an absolute miracle that is. Just absolute miracle. And, you know, I still see Al. There's still a handful of people that were at that very first meeting up in Seattle, the first meeting that I came to, that I see often. All these years later, there's still this handful of people that are sober. So I think what we'll do now is we'll take a break. And would somebody do me a favor? I should have took care of this with the housekeeping stuff. It would be really nice if somebody could be a timekeeper for us for this retreat. I should have asked Pacey about that, so that when I announce that we're going to be back at a, can you, or do we need somebody that's got the, okay, you're doing it? Okay, all right. He's the right guy, right? Okay. What was your name?
Dave.
Dave, again, thank you, Dave. So Dave, we're going to come back, and it's 8:36. We're going to come back in 15 minutes, which is so... Set your deal, 15-minute timer, and then remind everybody to come back in. And we're not going to do a big, long session. We're going to get everybody. I know everybody's had a long week. So thank you very much, everybody.